This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 27th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 393. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the big deal feature, Canada's 45th election is April 28th. Joining me are Democracy Watch co-founder Duff Conacher, who rates the party platforms, and BlackRock's reporter, managing editor Tom Korski, who looks back at the 2025 campaign. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. If you're listening on or before April 28th, make sure to get out and vote. It is the climax of Canada's snap election that began March 23rd. Before the first ballot is counted, however, we know that the loser is democracy. Just hear me out. The fixed election date law, broken for the second time in a row. Instead of the October 20th voting date, Canadians go to the polls on April 28th. That meant no budget in April and no adoption of January's Foreign Interference Report recommendations. Liberal Mark Carney has tested the bounds of the caretaker convention, acting as Prime Minister while on the campaign trail. There are questions about the influence of major media and opinion polls. Then there are the party platforms delivered late. But at least one Canadian read them, line by line. My first guest to talk about that is Duff Conacher, co-founder of Democracy Watch. The interview was recorded April 25th.
It's the fixed election date, broken for the second time in a row. Now, this has been a big issue federally and provincially for my guest, Duff Conacher, the co-founder of Democracy Watch, who has also looked at the platforms, taken a fine-tooth comb and looked at the platforms and rated those platforms. But before we talk about the platforms, the fixed election date, there's a good reason why governments should have a fixed election date. Duff, what are the consequences of not having a fixed election date or breaking the fixed election date? What does it do to democracy?
A fixed election date is better for everyone, except in many cases, the ruling party. It's better for candidates in terms of having candidates selected through nomination contests in their riding. About half the candidates in this election have been appointed because it was a snap election and the parties had to get candidates in place quickly. And so those candidates owe the party leader for their candidacy, not their vote, not voters in their riding. And so they're going to act like that after the election, that they owe the party leader a favor because the party leader got them a job if they get elected. It's better for the opposition parties, obviously, more fair for all the parties in terms of preparation for the election, and better for people volunteering, and just better because everyone expects it, and it's good for voter education and voter turnout. So we really should fix election dates as much as we can in our system, which would mean saying no election other than on the fixed election date, unless there's a vote of non-confidence in the ruling party in the legislature, which would then cause an election to happen before that fixed date.
Yeah, here in British Columbia, it was really pioneered by Gordon Campbell and the BC Liberals after they came to power in 2001. There were elections on a fixed date in 2005, 2009, 2013, 2017. But in 2020, it was John Horgan that broke that during the pandemic, won a big majority. Justin Trudeau saw that a year later in 2021 and tried to do the same thing, didn't win the majority, stayed a minority. And here we have Justin Trudeau, of course, resigning earlier this year, Mark Carney winning the Liberal leadership and deciding to go to the polls April 28th instead of, again, dealing with the Foreign Interference Commission recommendations, dealing with the budget. This should have been October 20th.
The election period has also been very short, and it should be extended. At the end of the debate, three of the four leaders, everyone except the Bloc leader, said that it hadn't been enough time to meet enough voters. Well, let's have election campaigns that are 6-7 weeks long, not the minimum, which is what Carney chose because he was riding a wave of support. and it was in his interest to have a very short campaign. It's better to have a couple of weeks more. The platforms would have come out earlier and left more time to analyze the platforms. Instead, people have only had a few days to do that. And we just need that extra time to for people to get aware that the election's happening and educate themselves before they vote.
That's right. If this had been stuck in the fall, there could have been platforms at the start of the campaign. Instead, in this election, the Liberals released their platform in the middle of early voting weekend. The Conservatives waited until after early voting weekend. Yes. It's almost like they don't want us to read those platforms, care about the platforms. They don't want to be held accountable for those promises. But Democracy Watch has done its duty this time again, and you have gone through those platforms and you've given ratings. You've said that the Green Party received the overall B grade, the Bloc, Conservatives and NDP a C minus, Liberals a D minus, and the People's Party of Canada an F. Now, in 2006, Democracy Watch gave the Conservatives a B. In 2015, Democracy Watch gave the Liberals a B. So start off with those two parties, why they have a poor rating this time.
We also should have had the anti-foreign interference bill C-65 passed before we had this election, and more measures implementing the Hogue inquiry's recommendations, because we've had foreign interference, disinformation, and we needed a lot of measures passed before having this election, which could have happened if the election had been on the fixed date. And we wouldn't have this election as it has been now, tainted by and undermined by foreign interference and disinformation. In terms of the parties, the Liberals really received a D minus because it's a negligently weak platform. It kind of matches Trudeau's record and the Trudeau cabinet's record and government's record since 2015. You know, they made 75 promises for open, accountable government and to clean up a bunch of areas in the 2015 election, and they've broken almost all of those promises, as well as being involved in multiple scandals, ignoring House committee reports, calling for reforms to whistleblower protection, anti-disinformation, foreign interference. Of course, they ignored that and tried to delay it. Mark Carney calls a snap election, is refusing to disclose his many financial investments, which cause conflicts of interest for him while he's making decisions that affect those financial interests as prime minister. And so we have Mark Carney, who has shown he's kind of has this father knows best attitude that favors secrecy over transparency and dismisses unethical conflicts of interest as a concern. And he's put forward a platform where if he wins, he's not promising any restrictions on his power, very little accountability, and that's pretty dangerous and worrying. In terms of the Conservatives, they've put forward what they call Accountability Act 2.0. The Federal Accountability Act in 2006 for the Conservatives was a comprehensive plan, 60 measures changing 6-7 different laws, increasing accountability. It was called the Federal Accountability Act. When it was introduced, they only kept 30 of the 60 promises, but it did take those 30 steps forward, whereas this new Accountability Act 2.0 that Pierre Poilievre has put forward on the Conservative platform pales in comparison. It would only make 10 changes, even if they win and keep all their promises, 9 of them in the area of strengthening ethics rules and 1 in the area of partially strengthening lobbying disclosure. And that's why they got a C minus instead of the B that we gave the Conservatives in 2006. And that's why the Liberals got a D minus, essentially a failure, compared to the B that we gave them in the 2015 platform.
Yeah, the other national party that got a C minus along with the Conservatives this time is the NDP. Why did the NDP get a C minus grade this time?
The NDP keeps forgetting its middle name when it does election promises, and a lot of times in between elections as well. It's the New Democrat Party, and yet they don't put forward comprehensive democratic reform platforms, haven't since 2015, when they also received a B, because they made 75 promises then. Tom Mulcair, the leader, essentially ignored them during the campaign. It's really quite silly. If you look at every federal provincial election since 93, you see that the party that promises a comprehensive cleanup politics platform highlights it during the campaign, wins more seats or wins the election. And the NDP haven't, even though that's the NDP, Democratic, they have not done that since 93 in any election. And I don't understand it. You'd have to ask them. It's right in their name, and they don't actually highlight Democratic reform and make comprehensive platform promises, except again in 2015. But then they released it on a Friday with the rest of the platform 10 days before the election. What did Justin Trudeau do in 2015 with the Liberals' platform? June 2015, well before the October election date, he released the whole platform, and then he highlighted it in almost every speech he gave after that. And the Liberals went from third to first and won that election. I don't understand why the NDP has not learned the lesson of so many past elections. The Conservatives did it in 2006, introduced the Federal Accountability Act platform early in the campaign. Harper highlighted it through the rest of the campaign, and they won that election. And the NDP, again, D for Democratic, has not done this in any election. It's really bizarre. You'd have to ask them why they don't think that voters care, when every poll that's been done in the last 20 years shows that 80% of voters to 90% of voters don't trust politicians and want all this stuff cleaned up so that everyone in federal politics is effectively required to be honest, ethical, transparent, make representative decisions, and prevent waste of the public's money.
Now, the Liberals of the national parties, the contending parties, got the lowest rating, D-, but the lowest rating overall in the survey was the F, the failure to the People's Party of Canada. Why did they score so low?
They proposed some measures in the area of efficient government, and our report card measures in five different areas: honest, ethical government, open government, representative government, efficient government, and then general government accountability proposals. And the PPC, Maxime Bernier, only put forward really some measures in the efficient government area and then some general government accountability proposals. So clearly, like most of the parties, really except the Greens, they want power, they would want to win power and not have accountability or restrictions on that power. You know, the other parties are not great either. The Liberals the worst, Bloc, Conservative, and NDP tied, and only the Greens really putting forward a comprehensive platform this time to clean up all these areas of politics and put in a effective requirements to be honest, ethical, transparent, representative, and waste preventing. All the parties, really except the Greens, want power without accountability or restrictions on the power, which is a sad comment in a democracy.
Now, the Greens, they've had problems recruiting candidates. They were in the debate, then they were out of the debate. But they are often the party that does put together the most thoughtful platform. Why did they deserve a B in this rating by Democracy Watch? What puts them above everyone else when it comes to promising transparency and accountability and reforms?
In the area of honest, ethical government, they promise the truth in political advertising law, which we need, and also to really regulate disinformation. Others mentioned disinformation, that we need to deal with it, but they actually said we need to regulate this, have someone be able to empowered to get disinformation off of social media. And also many provisions to clean up the area of government ethics, political ethics, lobbying ethics, and then an open government, strengthening the Access to Information Act, lobbying disclosure, and other transparency measures. Representative government, they put forward the proposal to change our really undemocratic voting system that allows a lot of parties to get majority power with the minority of the vote. And efficient government, that was their lowest grade. They put forward some measures, but not a lot of specifics about ensuring that waste is prevented. And then in a whole bunch of other areas, they want to increase accountability in the area of big businesses and many sectors, consumer protection, environmental protection, healthcare protection. So very comprehensive platform this time around. And you know, what happened in the debate shouldn't have happened. That was really the debate commission's fault. They shouldn't have had parties they should have waited till April 8th, which was the date when all candidates were confirmed, before they decided which parties would get to be in the debate. And they did it instead on April 1st. So the Greens were able to say, we have candidates in all these ridings, and then they didn't, by April 8th, actually have those candidates. And they also were not polling at 4% or above, which is another requirement. So if the debate commission had just waited till April 8th, then they would have been able to make a decision actually based on the criteria, instead of making an early decision and then having to, and then not having to, but reversing it at the last minute, which was a very unfair thing to do.
Thank you again to Duff Conacher, the co-founder of Democracy Watch, for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you, Bob. People can see more on our website, democracywatch.ca. And post-election, I'm predicting it will be a minority. I think that's how it's going to shake out. And we can talk about the fact that we don't have written rules to ensure fair decisions by the Governor General and everybody else when we have a minority government. Rules that Australia, New Zealand, and Great Britain enacted years ago. And we really need them here, because otherwise you have the ruling party really able to run things like they want, even if they have a minority of the seats in the House. So look forward to checking in again post-election.
An unusual campaign. Yes. Historic, perhaps. Pivotal, maybe. Will former banker and corporate titan Mark Carney remain prime minister and keep Justin Trudeau's former Liberal team in power for four more years? Will conservative career politician Pierre Poilievre end what he calls the lost Liberal decade of waste and corruption? Canadians will decide on April 28th. To talk about the last 5 weeks, the ups and downs, the highlights and the lowlights of the campaign, is Tom Korski, the managing editor of Blacklock's Reporter, which covers the federal government like no one else. You can find it at blacklocks.ca. Here is my interview with Tom Korski, recorded on April 25th.
How is this ranked for you among all the campaigns that you've covered?
That's an interesting point, Bob. There's no doubt it has had its own peculiarities. But in a way, they all do, and only with time do, in the midst of time, do start to see where it all played out and what the collective wisdom was of electors. I will say, the Liberal Party could not go back to the House of Commons. The early call was not a surprise. And the reason was they were facing a gridlock in the House that was, they couldn't even pass a budget bill. I mean, from the third week of September, the point of dispute was the cabinet's refusal to comply with an order of the House to disclose documents concerning a now disbanded program called Strategic Development Canada. It awarded millions in sweetheart grants to insiders, and the Department of Industry literally shut it down the day of an audit. So they could not go back to the House. The legislation was not passing. They wanted to increase capital gains, couldn't get it done. Mused about sending everyone a Christmas check, that didn't happen. And I think the cabinet was really petrified of going back to the House, so they really had no alternative, since they were right up against the end of the budget year. So you have two choices, either call an election or go back to the House, which was the nightmare scenario. And I think they took the only route they saw.
And speaking of nightmare scenarios, one of the stories that Blacklock's has brought Canadians was a nightmare scenario, a doomsday scenario, a dystopia report. It was from the Privy Council Office called Future Lives, Social Mobility in Question. It was a January report that was quietly published on Easter weekend, and Blacklock's brought that to its readers, and that became a talking point on the campaign trail. For those that not familiar with this report, talk about the report and how Blacklock's found it.
A staggering report. It was released in, I should, to answer your last point, Bob, there's has to be, I've never counted them, there have to be over a quarter million federal government web pages, which is where they now publish all their material, no longer on paper, and they grind out these reports and documents and various content on these quarter million web pages. It would be beyond human comprehension for anyone to check them all the time. We do our best. But the Department of Public Works thought of this, and so every Saturday they publish what they call a weekly acquisitions list. And this is hundreds and hundreds of titles of reports, new, old, good, bad, and ugly, some of them quite trivial, and some of them jaw-dropping, as was this. And it was buried in this weekly acquisition list on the Saturday that you mentioned. What does it say? It says that Canada, this is rated as a plausible outcome, their words, not mine, Canada in 15 years faces really societal collapse. They say that housing will be unaffordable for all but the wealthy, that wage earners will flee the country, and those of us who remain will be find that post-secondary education is going to be completely unobtainable unless you're wealthy, that there will be social and political disorder, and it will get so bad, in their words, that there will be poaching for wildlife, for food. It actually states this. The report says that as more people struggle to afford rent, bills, or groceries, there will be a problem with enforcement of wildlife laws, presumably as city dwellers on the weekends go out to the woods on Crown land to snare rabbits so they can eat. This is in the report. Unbelievable, Bob.
Here we are in 2025. What will the world be like in 15 years? What will Canada be like in 15 years, especially if present trends keep holding?
That's exactly the point, Bob. This is all a trajectory. It's an extension of current trends. They don't blame Donald Trump. They don't blame climate change or our bad friends in NATO. This is us. This is a government report describing systemic failure by the government. It's unbelievable.
During this election period, Mark Carney paused the campaign several times, including to talk to Donald Trump, and he didn't really tell the truth about what he said in the March 28th meeting. That caught up with him eventually. And at the same time, there has been the $40 billion that the government decided to allot itself to keep the lights on because, of course, no budget right now. That included almost $180 million to keep the CBC on the air, and Blacklock's reported about that. And why that's interesting, of course, is the media coverage of the campaign and the media coverage of the debate, which turned into quite a debacle.
That's interesting, Bob. I think this is one of the big takeaways of the election. It's funny you should mention it. So few have. I think the media landscape has permanently altered. I've been doing this for a while, as have you. It is not the same. It is never going back. Some of us say good riddance. So the day of sitting down and having Harvey Kirk on the CTV National News tell you this story of the day and you'd huddle around your one-channel universe, forget it. It's gone. It's never coming back. I think media have been very slow, especially heritage media and the television networks, and the subsidized newspapers have been very slow to understand that the world has changed. And it will never, never return to what it once was. What happened at the debates? Well, there was, speaking of alternative media, Rebel News Network, twice they had to go to federal court after they were blacklisted by the Leaders Debates Commission under the guise of the Canadian Parliamentary Press Gallery. Twice they went to a federal judge, and twice they won. This was unstated this time. I think the Department of Justice must have told the Debates Commission, knock it off. Why are we spending six figures on legal fees and you guys keep losing? So they let the Rebel News Network in. They queued up at the microphone, asked questions after the French language debate. Well, it was pandemonium because they didn't ask the questions of which their associates in the parliamentary press gallery approved. Well, isn't that too bad, Bob? I'm telling you, we live in a changing world. But the fake aristocracy, forgive my blunt language, the fake aristocracy here in Lumbertown in Ottawa, in eastern Ontario, would be the last to know what the deep trends are. And one of the deep trends is the day of legacy media telling you, you listen, they talk, they will tell you what the story is, you act accordingly, it's gone. It is so gone.
Mark Carney himself has been in the legacy media. He was chair of Bloomberg, for instance, not only chair of Brookfield Asset Management, but also chair of Bloomberg until this election happened, as well as the interesting connections to a New York consultancy, the Eurasia Group, which is where Mark Carney's wife, Diana Fox Carney, worked. That's where Evan Solomon, one of the liberal candidates, worked. And of course, Gerald Butts, who was chief of staff, the principal secretary for Justin Trudeau and key in the liberal campaigns, that's where he hangs his hat. So if Mark Carney and the Liberals win, we'll have various connections to a consultancy out of New York, and we don't know who all their clients are.
Absolutely. And Eurasia is also a federal contractor. $829,000 in contracts from the Department of Natural Resources in the last 5 years. Both the Prime Minister and his wife drew income from federal contractors up until Christmas. This is not ancient history, as you mentioned. There's an act of Parliament that's called the Conflict of Interest Act. Carney, since he is not a member of Parliament and only now has become what is defined as a public office holder under the legal terminology of the bill, is now subject to disclosure, but has said he is going to put it all in a blind trust. And of course, now I can't tell you what I knew I owned last week because I just put it into a blind trust. What does that act say, by the way? This is how extraordinary this is. And this is not a hell-raising act, Bob. Like, transparency is not the watchword in Ottawa. But what does the act say? It says if you own any asset over approximately $10,000 outside of a principal residence, you must report it. That includes a cabin in the woods where you like to go fishing in the winter. If you owe $10,000 or more, you must report it. It must be reported to the Ethics Commissioner, and it must be, you must tell the world. And the Ethics Commissioner will publish this. There are MPs who have to report debts as modest as student loans or lines of credit. They must report their spouse's sources of income. They must report their stock holdings. This is the most elemental question of transparency. Carney's done none of that. We don't know what he owns, except for stock options worth some $10 million from Brookfield Asset Management, but that was only because Brookfield had to report it to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. We know nothing about Carney. Carney is the wealthiest prime minister we've had since Paul Martin, was CEO of Canada Steamship Lines, and today it's very uncommon to have a multimillionaire elected prime minister, but he's one of them. And he has had, as we discuss, these relationships with federal contractors. It's getting a little close. It's pretty close, Bob.
And there's also questions about some of the deals that Brookfield did with China while Mark Carney was chair of that company, which of course moved its headquarters to the United States in New York. And there's been questions about China that have popped up along this campaign trail. The Election Monitor Task Force has said that China was using WeChat to interfere in the Canadian election by calling Mark Carney a rock star economist. They also found that China was targeting conservative candidate Zhou Tay on Facebook. Zhou Tay, who's a activist in favor of democracy in Hong Kong, who of course was the target of Liberal Paul Chang, who of course was replaced by another pro-China candidate. Given the chance to get rid of Paul Chang as a candidate, Mark Carney stuck with him until Paul Chang decided to take himself out of the game himself. What do you think of this?
Don Valley North is a disgrace. I will say all of this is extraordinary in a G7 country. It would be extraordinary at town council, let alone national affairs of a G7 country. There was a parliamentary committee, and this was a committee of MPs and senators. And last June, they issued a report. And they said, we have a problem with legislators on Parliament Hill who have acted in the pay and for the benefit of certain foreign embassies here in town. Some of this may be illegal, said the report. Successive cabinet ministers testified at the Commission on Foreign Interference that they had read this report. They were aware of it. They wouldn't name names. The most reflective moment that Liberal cabinet members had in discussing this damning report, which is, by the way, written by a committee chaired by a Liberal MP, David McGinty, Ottawa South. What they said was, well, we don't think it was illegal, but we think some people made some bad choices. Opposition has said, name names. How can you allow the electors to cast ballots without naming names? Shouldn't they know if they were about to vote for or against someone who acted on behalf of foreign agents and cabinet refused? And then we come into the campaign period, where one MP, Chandra Area, who was originally South Asian national, a Canadian citizen now, he was dropped as a Liberal candidate in a suburban Ottawa riding called Nepean, where the new prime minister could seek the nomination. He was previously disqualified as a Liberal leadership candidate. Why? They were asked. Well, that's secret, said the party. Can you imagine? You wouldn't do this at the county library board. And then there was the MP you mentioned from Markham, a former police officer, who said that my conservative opponent should be rounded up and delivered to the Chinese consulate. You can collect a $1 million bounty, he said. And there was defense of that. There have been numerous documents released through the Commission on Foreign Interference that there were 11 suspicious public office holders. They didn't release the names. The only reason we know what we know, Bob, is because the opposition dragged this cabinet kicking and screaming into a Commission on Foreign Interference, and they've been trying to resist it ever since. It's obvious we don't know all that we should know, and cabinet doesn't want to talk about it. You know, I'll tell you, there was a Conservative MP, Frank Caputo, former Crown Prosecutor. He said it in committee one time. He said, let's put the cards on the table. If those were 11 Conservative MPs, you'd be telling the world, wouldn't you? He said this to the Minister of Public Safety, looked him right in the eye. But you don't want to talk about it at all. That tells us all we need to know. I think he nailed it.
And finally, this has been a campaign with some interesting twists and turns. We had Buttongate.
Always dirty tricks. It wouldn't be a national campaign without dirty tricks. And very often it's funny that we find out about much of it after. It's always nice to get that information in real time. The more information for electors, the better, we always say. But you know, Bob, people get hot and angry. There's a lot riding on these elections. You know, when the tide goes out, and typically this is not a law, it just seems to be a sort of a custom that's developed over the last generation. Governments typically last about 10 years. I've known, for instance, Liberal Party organizers who just about lost their house under the Harper years. It's no joke. Lots riding on this. So, of course, you resort to shenanigans, because otherwise you're pretty much unemployable in this town if your team doesn't win. Oh, sure. Very high feelings. And everyone gets very hot and angry. But it's always nice to know before you cast a vote, that's for sure.
Well, we look forward to finding out who gets employed after April 28th. One great way for people to keep an eye on that is through BlackLock's reporter, blacklocks.ca. They're minding Ottawa. That's their slogan, and they do a great job of it. And I'm glad to again have on the podcast Tom Korski, the managing editor. Thanks again.
Thank you kindly, Bob.
It's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, China targets gangs, temples to infiltrate Taiwan. According to the National Security Bureau, infiltration tactics include establishing underground banks to funnel Chinese capital as a means of luring individuals to join the Chinese Communist Party, and exploiting temples to attract military personnel for the collection and transfer of sensitive intelligence. The CCP had worked to establish online connections and lure China-based Taiwanese businessmen to contact government officials using fake identities to gather sensitive information. In Kyoto News, U.S. Marines from Okinawa to start moving to Guam barracks in June. Currently, some 18,000 Marine Corps are stationed in Okinawa. The relocation to Guam is based on the U.S.-Japan agreement reached by the two countries in 2006. The cost of the transfer is estimated at $8.7 billion, of which up to $2.8 billion will be covered by the Japanese government. In Hong Kong Free Press, court lets Cardinal Zen leave Hong Kong for Pope's funeral after passport earlier confiscated over security law arrest. Hong Kong authorities confiscated Zen's passport after his initial arrest in 2022 on suspicion of collusion with foreign forces under a Beijing-imposed national security law. He does not currently face charges under the legislation. The cardinal and four other pro-democracy activists are seeking to overturn their convictions linked to a defunct protest fund that was active during the 2019 protests and unrest. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, Matt Donegan has a plan to stop Oregon from burning. Think Moneyball for forests. In 2024, the state saw 1.9 million acres burn, an area more than twice the size of Rhode Island. The Oregon Department of Forestry was beset by scandal, management turmoil, and near bankruptcy from the cost of putting out blazes. Donegan's theory goes like this. Fire is a natural and healthy phenomenon, and we need more of it to restore forest health. The problem is, the forests are so overstocked with dead, dry debris after a century of fire suppression, that fires easily become catastrophic rather than restorative. In the Washington State Standard, Washington legislature approves hiking Discover Pass price to $45. The Discover Pass allows motor vehicle access to more than 100 state parks and hundreds of other recreation sites on state land. The price would rise by $15 later this year under a bill headed for Governor Bob Ferguson's desk. Revenue from pass sales goes to Washington State Parks, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Department of Natural Resources, with Washington State Parks receiving the bulk of the revenue. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. Globetrotting Liberal Star candidate ashamed of flying, peeved at pipelines. And Vancouver East contenders are not Vancouver East residents. And in closed-door chat with Port Moody mayor, Liberal candidate advocated for husband's client, admitted conflict of interest. Read the stories behind these headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the scientists who are seeking a cure for Parkinson's disease and the doctors and nurses who help Parkinson's patients live their best life. April is Parkinson's Awareness Month in British Columbia. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 27th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 27th of April in 1967, Expo 67 opened in Montreal? The Man and His World World's Fair was the biggest celebration of Canada's centennial year. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com.
Until next week.